The English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Saudi Arabia conducts fresh airstrikes on Yemen, targeting the international airport in the capital Sana'a. Israelis gather outside the residence of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem Al-Quds, calling for his resignation. And people rally in the U.S. city of Atlanta in Georgia in support of the Asian American community in the wake of a deadly shooting which left six Asian women dead. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Saudi Arabia has carried out fresh airstrikes on Yemen's Sana'a International Airport. Yemeni media said the airport was hit twice, but there were no immediate reports on possible damage or casualties. Saudi-led coalition warplanes also conducted airstrikes against targets at a port in the western province of Hodeidah. Riyadh and its Arab allies launched a deadly war and blockade on Yemen back in early 2015. The conflict has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, and resulted in what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Yemeni army has in recent weeks ramped up its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been facing months of protests over his corruption charges and handling of the coronavirus crisis. During our news review program, we discuss the issue with our guests. Here it is. Thousands of Israelis have held a fresh demonstration against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. The rally was held just days before a general election, which could see him removed from office. Netanyahu has been in power for a record 12 consecutive years. He's hoping to remain in office following Israel's fourth election in less than 2 years, this March 23rd. Netanyahu is facing corruption charges. He went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but denies any wrongdoing. Israelis have been staging street rallies against him over the past 38 weeks. And now joining us for this news review is Yves Angler, author and commentator from Montreal, and Firas Al-Majid, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Firas, I guess we'll start with you. Your thoughts on, there was a time that Benjamin Netanyahu was very popular with his own people. What's happened to him?
Well, I guess first I want to congratulate everybody for Nowruz that's celebrating. Netanyahu is a big war criminal. The man has committed many war crimes himself. Before he was elected as a prime minister, he's been an IDF soldier and he's been up in the ranks. This person is, he has no respect for any international laws. Obviously, that means he doesn't have any respect for any laws inside of his country. A person that doesn't care about any laws, and dealings with the whole world. And he called the ICC, the International Criminal Court, a kangaroo court. He has no respect for any courts, any court systems, any governments. He sent out his Mossad to assassinate people in different places in the world. I mean, like you said, like this, it's nice to see that there's actually a movement from inside that is against him. But we don't know what the results are going to be. Like, is he going to be ousted? Is he not going to regain power?
Okay, thank you. And Yves Angler, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Now, 38 weeks, that's almost a year of protesting outside his residence there. And for the majority of it, for practically all of it, it's been throughout this pandemic. So people have been, braving, risking their health to get their point across. to their so-called prime minister. Your thoughts on what's irked the Palestinians, the Israelis, to this point where they turned against this man?
Well, my understanding is that it's about his corruption. It's about his handling of the pandemic. It's not much about his ongoing dispossession of Palestinians, the continued occupation, Israeli bombing in Syria, Israel's assassinations in Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that it is, you know, it's better that there are Israelis protesting Netanyahu than not. I think that for most of the world, for most people who, you know care about the long oppressed Palestinians, whether it's Netanyahu or Naftali Bennett that wins the upcoming election, it's not going to change things a whole lot, unfortunately. In fact, this might be the first time that a non-Likud right-wing president wins, or prime minister, sorry, takes over in Israel, because it's the whole spectrum in Israel has gone so far to the anti-Palestinian racist kind of direction. But yeah, it's a good thing they're protesting, and I think there's some element of sympathy for Palestinians among the protesters. But unfortunately, that's not the driving force.
And Yves, do you think it's just a denunciation of Netanyahu himself by these protesters, or the greater Likud party?
Yeah, I think it's a heavily personalized element, which is understandable. I mean, he's been there for way too long. He is corrupt. He's a bad guy. But I think that unfortunately for those looking from outside, the getting rid of Netanyahu won't change things as much as need to be changed.
And do you agree with that, Firas, that Netanyahu is just, one part of the one piece of this this puzzle, that, whether it's him or Gantz or any other guy, basically, Palestinians are going to suffer apartheid and marginalized living standards?
Yes, this is systematic. They have this embedded in their system that the Palestinians have no rights. The Palestinians should be, driven out of the country. I mean, like we've seen with the deal of century, what they crafted there was a joke, It's a joke of the century. I mean, they want to leave them like leftovers on the side and put them in pretty much like kind of concentration camps and have no military and no strength at all. It's exactly like how Trump is and Biden. I mean, they're both, involved in all the war crimes and exploiting and plundering resources, dividing the region, and so on. And that's the agenda of the Israelis. At the end of the day, it's the Zionists, they're going to continue to do it. They just have different faces. I guess the people are just sick of this face. They want a new face, just like how people were sick of Trump. I mean, even though Trump didn't stay for 12 years, but because of the things that he did, he worked very arrogantly, very unprofessional, so that's why they got rid of him. This guy was able to stay longer inside power because he's better at deceiving and manipulating and acting. He's a good actor, I guess. And he doesn't, he doesn't just show exactly his arrogance as much as, for instance, Trump is. So, yeah, it's going to continue the same kind of war crimes, same kind of violations, I guess there is some resistance in the region that will know how to deal with the situation, hopefully.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. And Yves Engler, author and commentator, joining us out of Montreal. And Firas Alnaji, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa. And welcome back, everyone. Over 500 international organizations have urged the UN Human Rights Council to denounce Israel's war crimes against the Palestinian people. The organization has called on the world body to establish an independent fact-finding mission into Israel's apartheid regime. They're calling for an investigation of crimes the regime has committed against Palestinians, including home demolitions and illegal settlement construction in the occupied West Bank. The organizations have urged the international community to use all available mechanisms to achieve international justice and accountability. They call for immediate action against Israel to hold accountable individuals who may have committed war crimes against Palestinians. Thousands of people have joined a demonstration in Turkey after the country withdrew from an international treaty designed to protect women. Protesters took to the streets of the cities of Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir, calling on President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to reverse his decision. On Saturday, the government pulled out of the Istanbul Convention, signed in 2011. The binding treaty calls for preventing, prosecuting, and eliminating domestic violence against women. But the Turkish government says the treaty damaged family unity and encourages divorce. The withdrawal sparked international outrage, with several European countries, including France and Germany, condemning the move. Domestic violence and femicide have been on the rise in Turkey in recent years. Hundreds of people have gathered outside the Georgia state capitol in Atlanta in support of the Asian American community. Protests come amid mounting violence against Asians who are being blamed for the coronavirus crisis. The demonstrators carried posters bearing slogans denouncing discrimination against Asians. Two Georgia senators also took part in the rally. Earlier, U.S. President Joe Biden denounced the rise of hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans in the U.S., and it comes after eight people, mostly Asian women, were killed in a series of attacks in Atlanta.
The United States has witnessed yet another hate crime against minority groups that sparked a nationwide debate over the threats these people are facing in the country. On Wednesday, a white man gunned down eight people, including six Asian women, at spas around Atlanta. The incident raised fears that it might be a new wave of attacks on Asian Americans. A report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said racially motivated extremists pose the most lethal domestic terrorism threats to the U.S. It also warned that threats from domestic violent extremism are metastasizing across the country and could grow in 2021. Hate crimes against minorities in the U.S. have significantly increased over the past years, as former President Donald Trump explicitly favored white people over people of color. Many African Americans and Hispanics have been attacked or killed by white police officers or extremist groups. Asian Americans are in no better condition. They have been grappling with a rise in hate crimes since the coronavirus outbreak, as Trump directly blamed China for the pandemic. Now the question is, how would a country whose foundation has been built on killing the minorities manage to get rid of racism, which has been entrenched in its culture for centuries?
And joining us now out of Milwaukee is a Christian T. Harris, journalist and radio host. The fact that the intelligence apparatus just, you know, not even 2 weeks ago came out with that report that they feel domestic extremism is going to be the biggest threat to national security. We could talk about gun violence. We could talk about racism. However you want to handle it, you start the conversation.
Well, first of all, my condolences to the victims and their family members. Any death by violence is senseless. Overall, in America, statistics show that hate crimes are down. However, in cities of New York and Los Angeles, they are showing an uptick. In fact, when it comes to hate crimes, Asians are in the top 10. They're number 10 when you pull up the FBI numbers here in America, behind a large different array of individuals. Let's be honest. Any race-motivated attack or crime is racism, and it's wrong. The issue is here in Atlanta, white people were shot as well. It wasn't just Asian. I don't know if it was really racially motivated as the media portrays. I think the idea of running towards the idea of racism being rampant in America, it's actually on a downfall. It's coming, you know, people are being less violent based on statistics anyways.
And what about the fact that you have, you know, a little over 300 million people in America and over 400 million guns, and throughout Donald Trump's tenure, there was unprecedented purchases of more guns?
Yeah, I believe a lot of that may have been due to the political climate with COVID-19. During COVID-19, there was a large spike of purchase of guns. In fact, there are record-breaking amounts of sales of guns. However, the people that commit crimes with guns make up a very small percentage of those that own guns. In fact, majority of people that are involved in domestic terrorism or mass shooting are actually on antidepressants. That's one of the links no one wants to talk about or go after Big Pharma for, is that almost 100%, almost 99.9% of people involved in mass shootings take antidepressants that say right on the pill bottle may cause depression, suicidal thoughts. And what do you think is going to happen when they get these suicidal thoughts? They start, acting, you know.
Right, and do you buy it that a lot of people feel Donald Trump is directly responsible? His rhetoric, calling it the Kung Flu, China virus, and basically, lambasted the Chinese for this virus. Do you think his rhetoric has impacted the rise in hate crimes against Asians? And irrespective of what happened in Atlanta, you mentioned it's still not conclusive. The jury's still out if that was an anti-Asian hate crime there, but irrespective of that, there have been an uptake in crimes against Asians since this pandemic kicked off. How much of it is attributed to Donald Trump?
I honestly can't speak for that. I don't know what these individuals are thinking and why, or what kind of political leanings are. Each individual case needs to be looked at separately from each another. We can't lump them in. That's dangerous talk, because you're trying to unify a nation, and all of that kind of conversation would cause a segregation, which is the opposite of unity, right? Mm-hmm. So our main focus should be on, first of all, crazy people are going to kill people. Does it really matter if they're racist, if they're crazy? I may think not. I think that what you're doing is you are, making it sound like that some lives have more value than other when you classify them as hate crimes. Now, I do believe that racist-motivated crimes are racist and that they do occur. I just think that the media is, in America anyway, is definitely working towards restricting freedom of speech, and this is one of the many tools they have, because if you can start somewhere to ban speech, it just opens the door for them to come for other things. It's a slippery slope, and as we know, when government takes away your rights and your freedoms, they never give them back.
Thanks, bud. Stay safe. Joining us out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is Mr. Christian T. Harris, journalist and radio host. President Biden's China policy is not off to a good start, as American and Chinese diplomats engage in bitter exchanges during their first in-person meeting. The Alaska talks show the frosty ties between the two rivals are not going to thaw anytime soon.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S. quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. Every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future.
We'll have to wrap it up with that, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. Bye-bye for now.
The beginning of spring is finally here. Happy Nowruz. Happy the beginning of spring.
Happy Nowruz, the rainy new year.
Nowruz reminds us that life continues and hope increases. Happy Nowruz. Happy the beginning of spring.
In the limelight.
A self-powered robot inspired by a fish can survive the extreme pressures at the bottom of the ocean's deepest trench thanks to its soft body and distributed electronic system, and might enable exploration of the uncharted ocean. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Cecilia Lasci Ryder. This article is published under the heading Soft Robot Reaches the Deepest Part of the Ocean. Stay tuned for more. Riding in nature, Lee et al. Report a robot made from soft materials that can brave the unexplored depth of the sea. Remarkably, the authors demonstrate that the robot can operate in the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. Conventional underwater vehicles require watertight enclosures made of metallic materials to withstand the high pressures of the deep ocean. The thickness and dimensions of these enclosures have to be increased to cope with greater depth. But in Lee and colleagues' robot, the delicate electronic components are embedded and distributed in soft silicon, a design that removes the need for pressure-resistant cases. Largely inspired by living organisms, the field of soft robotics involves making robots from pliable materials. Polymers such as silicon are often used, as well as highly deformable structures such as braids and textiles. Soft robots are intrinsically safer than their conventional rigid counterparts in interactions with humans, and their pliability can boost many capabilities, such as their dexterity when manipulating objectives, and their ability to squeeze into tight spaces or to travel across uneven surfaces. Marine species such as squid and octopus were one of the original inspirations for soft robotics research. But soft robotics in turn offers a new approach for tackling marine applications of robots. Lee and colleagues' work is a powerful demonstration of this. The author's robot is designed to have a fish-like body shape and two flapping side fins. The authors used a well-established mechanism to drive flapping. The fins are attached to muscles on the robot's body. These are made of a soft material that converts electrical energy into mechanical work. When an electric current from the robot's battery is applied to the muscles, they contract. Tiny solid structures mechanically connect the contracting muscles to the fins, making them flap. One of the challenges faced by Lee and co-workers was finding a way to protect the robot's electronic components from high pressures. Taking inspiration from the bones in the skull of the Haddle snailfish, the authors spaced the electronic components apart rather than packing them together as is typically done in electronic devices. Laboratory tests and simulations demonstrated that this arrangement reduces the stress at the interfaces between components under pressure. The distributed electronics were then embedded in silicon for incorporation into the robot. This approach is more practical and cheaper than other methods for protecting electronics in deep sea devices. Li et al. First tested the swimming ability of the robot in the lab, in a pressurized water chamber. The robot was connected to a pole, which it swam around in a circle. The machine was then tested in a lake at a depth of 70 meters, where it swam freely at a speed of 3.16 centimeters per second, and then in South China Sea at a depth of about 3,200 meters. It reached a speed of 5.19 centimeters, equivalent to 45/10th body length per second, which is in line with the capabilities of other soft robots. Finally, the flapping movement and pressure resistance of the robot were tested in the Mariana Trench, where it was connected to a conventional underwater robot for support, which also took images of the test. Several previous attempts have been made to develop soft robots for applications underwater, a realm in which it is challenging for robots to interact delicately with objects because robotic sensors don't work well in this environment. Soft robotic grippers offer substantial advantages over rigid grasping devices when collecting and handling delicate sea organisms for study by marine biologists. And bio-inspired soft robotic fishes can swim among other animals without distressing them, thereby allowing close-up study. Li and co-workers' research now pushes the boundaries of what can be achieved. The replacement of rigid protective enclosures for electronic components by distributed electronics embedded in a soft material paves the way for a new generation of deep-sea explorers. There is, however, more work to do before the ocean can be populated with robots of this type of design. Li and co-workers' machine is slower than previously reported underwater robots and cannot withstand sizable disturbances. It could easily be swept away by underwater currents. Its locomotor capabilities will also need to be optimized for practical applications. However, Li and colleagues' approach lays the foundations for future generations of resilient and reliable deep-sea explorers. In the long term, one can predict avenues of research being opened up for marine biology, in which soft robots safely navigate coral reefs or underwater caves to collect delicate specimens without damaging them. Swarms of underwater soft robots with the ability to crawl on the seabed, anchor themselves on to specific structures, or swim over particular areas could contribute to the development of technologies for various other applications. These might include monitoring the ocean, cleaning up, and preventing sea pollution, or preventing marine biodiversity. More fundamentally, they could help researchers to explore the vast uncharted depth of the oceans.
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وَبِهِ نَسْتَعِينَ إِنَّهُ خَيْرُ نَاصِرٍ وَمُؤِينٍ. The month is the month of Sha'ban, the month of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The occasions in which we do have some relevance to our imams, such as the birthday of imams or martyrdoms of imams, we should have some good benefits of these occasions in seeking a proximity to God and performing our responsibility and duties toward these imams. And the one who is aware of his own personality and his relationship to his own imam can take benefit more of these occasions. Then let us focus on ourselves, focus on the day and night that we are in, and seek God's forgiveness, mercy, and blessings through our imams, especially Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam. Talking about the personality of Imam Al-Husayn is not so easy for me, because Imam is such a notion, we cannot talk about the depth of this personality. But to the extent of our own understanding, we can talk a little bit about his characteristics and nobility, and take our own benefit to the extent of our own perception of this imam. Just one point I want to focus on, and then to go next to that point and come to an end, inshallah, at the end, good conclusion I want to mention. Imam had many, many characteristics, and you all know about most of them. I don't want to talk about these things. Just one issue is very important for me in the life of Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, and that is his generosity. I remember a story. In this story, one of the Arabs, you know, Bedouin Arab, came to Imam Al-Husayn asking for something, some debt that he had. He said, "Oh Hussein, because I guaranteed full, you know, payment of blood price for somebody, and now I'm empty-handed, I don't have enough money to pay, then I decided to come to the door of the most generous person, and that is you. I'm asking for that money, if you give me." Imam said, "I want to ask you three questions. If you answer the first one, I'll give you 1/3 of the money. If you answer the second one, I'll give you 2/3 of your money and debt. If you answer the whole questions that I'm, you know, asking, then you can receive the whole money and the debt that you're wanting." He said, "You are Imam and the most knowledgeable person. You're asking me something and you're expecting that I can be able to do that? To answer the questions?" "Okay." Imam said, "Prophet Muhammad had something here. He said, generosity, goodness is due to the extent of knowledge. If you want to pay something, you have to consider the understanding of that person who is in need." He said, "Okay, if you want me to be so, then I'm ready. If I know the answer, I can talk about the answer. If I don't know, I can learn it from you." This is the best occasion for learning. Imam started to ask the first question. Ayyul a'mal afdal? What is the best deed in your point of view? There are many, many deeds are recommended in Islam. Which one is the best? He said, Al-Imanu billah. Faith in God is the best deed. If you believe in God, then you've done the best action. If you don't believe, nothing works. And other works are useless. And other actions are rewardless. First, believe in God. So, believe and faith is counted as an action here. And this is the best action because this is the action of heart and soul. Aqdul qalb. So, this is some action. It's going to be done by our heart. And the best action, believe in God. Well done. The second question. فَمَنْ نَجَاتُ مِنَ الْهَلَكَ What is the salvation and safety from the danger? You want to save yourself, your life? What is the way for that? To be immune from danger. Is there another way for that? He said, "Al-thiqatu billah." Trust in God. Reliance in God. You know, sometimes we're thinking about a supporter for us, to support us in our difficulties. We're seeking for a helper to help us in our need. In our difficulties. The best helper and supporter is God Himself. You have to rely on God, not other people. God is the most strongest one. He is strong. He is stable. He is powerful. We have to trust in God, not other people. Well done. This is the second question. You answered them successfully. The third one and the final question. Imam asked the person, فَمَا يُزَيِّنُ الرَّجُلُ What adorns human being? What is the adornment of mankind? Is that best dressing? Is that gold and silver? Is that fashion that we have today? What is the adornment of mankind? He said, عِلْمٌ مَعَهُ حِلْمٌ This is the adornment of mankind. Knowledge accompanied by حِلْم, tolerance, insight, patience. If you're alim, without practicing any kind of tolerance, then this ilm is not useful for you. You have to tolerate another people who are knowledgeable or lay people. You have to stand them. Yes, you may face some people who are against your own idea, who are against your dignity. They behave in a way, they harm your dignity, your position in the society. You have to tolerate them. We understand all these things from the tradition of Prophet and the other Imams. How they tolerate the lay people. They didn't know a respectful way of treating. But Prophet and Imams stand them. This is something we have to understand. And focus on brothers. قال عليه السلام فإن أخطأه ذلك Imam asked the person, if he missed that, then what? If there's no, you know, science with tolerance, is there another thing to, you know, replace that? He said, فمال معه مروءة. Wealth and property accompanied by generosity. If you have property without generosity, then you're wasting your time. Then you're not worthy of being, you know, respected by the other people. If you have mal, properties, wealth, you have to give it in the way of Allah. You have to engage in some charities. Because there are some, you know, amount of your money are belong to another people, for the needy people. All of these things are not yours. You have to think about other people. قال عليه السلام فإن أخطأه ذلك. If he missed that again, what is the duty? What is the best action after that? The Arab said, فقر معه صبر. Poverty accompanied by patience. Poverty is bad situation if there is no patience in that. But if you tolerate, if you stand, if you, you know, practice iman, patience, tolerance in that situation, then this is adornment for you. Then the adornment is the situation in which we're going to practice our own duties and responsibility. No matter to be a poor person or to be a rich person, you have to practice your own duty and responsibility. And then Imam said, فَإِنْ أَخْطَاهُ ذَلِكَ. If he missed that again, so what? قال فصاعقة تنزل من السماء فتحرقه. Then a thunderbolt comes from the sky, hits it and burns it. He should be dead. He is not right to live then. Okay? Then Imam smiled and gave him, you know, the whole price of the blood he guaranteed. And then he gave him extra. He gave him his ring to spend for his life expenses and for himself. Okay? So Imam says to be a generous person, you have to consider the level of understanding and the knowledge of the needy people. And to the extent of their knowledge, you can pay. Okay? This is something mentioned here. Oh Allah, for the sake of this Imam, please forgive our sins and please put us among real Shia of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and among the helpers of Imam al-Mahdi. أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Prosperous is he,
prosperous is he,
who spends his wealth on the poor and needy, who speaks a kind word to kin and neighbor, ever grateful for Allah's favor. Guided is he,
guided is he,
who prays Salah with punctuality. Early morning tahajjud he prays, for Allah's pleasure and nearness he craves.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Food delivery service has entered the scene as part of a second wave of mobile digital services in mid-2010s. In the beginning, these services focused on reaching critical mass with a large enough selection of options for consumers to recognize them as a viable alternative to dining in. As they grew, their business shifted from one driven to acquire restaurants to one driven to acquire customers, and finally one driven to maximize profits. We now present you an article written by Wayne McDonald under the heading, Big Tech Food Delivery Services Are Eating Your Lunch. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Wayne McDonald's article. Not long ago, if you wanted to order delivery from a restaurant, assuming they even supported it, you would have to first know the restaurant exists, find their contact information, fight through an outdated paper menu, and manage some type of payment and delivery. Food delivery services entered the scene as part of a second wave of mobile digital services in mid-2010s. In the beginning, these services focused on reaching critical mass, with a large enough selection of options for consumers to recognize them as a viable alternative to dining in. As they grew, their business shifted from one driven to acquire restaurants to one driven to acquire customers, and finally one driven to maximize profits. Currently, rather than be courted by these services, restaurants are often left fighting over poor service, hefty fees, and a bizarre, gamified marketplace of price manipulation that limits the agility of restaurants. First meetings with nearly all major operators, that is, Uber, Foodpanda, Gojek, Grab, etc., are largely the same. Coming armed with exclusivity contracts that limit a restaurant's ability to be listed on competitive platforms and cement pricing in such a way that restaurants are not allowed to offer different prices between food delivery listings and on-site, food delivery services have managed to worm their way into a key position in the daily lives of consumers at the angst of restaurateurs. A typical food delivery contract includes a fee of 30% or more of revenue from the restaurant sales, a commitment to not underprice, and an exclusivity clause limiting fair competition. In exchange, restaurants can get a basic listing among hundreds of competitors that provide search, payment, and delivery processing. Years ago, when these services were growing, it was possible to reliably contact them to resolve issues, and many even provided packaging for food, something that today comes at extra cost. Fast forward to today, and most restaurants are listed on multiple sites. Free delivery packaging has disappeared, and food delivery services are pushing to increase their fees from 30% to 40%. All this while restaurants struggle due to social distancing measures and food delivery experiencing explosive growth. To put things in perspective, let's quickly look at some basic global benchmarks for operating a restaurant. According to 7Shifts, a leading employee scheduling software vendor for restaurants, the following monthly operating costs are typical: rent and utilities, that is electricity, water, internet, cable and phone, 5% to 10% of revenues. Food costs, 25 to 40% of food sales. And labor costs, roughly 30% of revenues. 7Shifts says the three major costs, that is manpower, rent and cost of goods, should not exceed 70% of overall revenue. Now throw in branding and marketing, packaging, IT, maintenance, training, etc., and many restaurants are very likely running below 10% profit. Apply that math to the food delivery service model, and many restaurants are losing money just to be listed. In nearly all cases, it is better for restaurants to do their own direct deliveries, even if that means losing the exposure that a food delivery service listing can offer. With just a fraction of the money saved, a restaurant can use Google and Facebook advertisements to promote and provide greater quality control. If you're lucky enough to have a distinct brand or product, customers may welcome directly to you anyway. Remember that listing on a food delivery service puts every restaurant in direct competition, where consumers are driven primarily by price and selection over quality and brand. Often this means established brick-and-mortar businesses are left competing with cloud or dark kitchens that have been specifically optimized for low-cost structures. Even darker, some of these cloud kitchens are owned by the food delivery services themselves. Food delivery services use gamification, incentives, and discounts to distort restaurant listings and prioritize companies willing to pay even more. This is in direct opposition to their own contract terms that prevent restaurants from having lower prices on site than those listed on the food delivery service app or website, and all but restrict restaurants from listing on multiple platforms. Food delivery services were not birthed in the food industry. Rather, they are the brainchild of a technology industry that is hungry to turn every possible industry into a marketplace and secure the role of aggregator, IT expert, and middleman. The very business model of marketplaces is to be large enough to manipulate businesses and become a necessary evil, turning views and clicks into profit. Do not fall for the classic startup line that they are in it to bridge the gap between buyers and sellers. That may be the opportunity, but as businesses, they exist to attract venture capital, investment, and ultimately a tidy buyout. This is business after all. While perceivably easy for the consumer, food delivery services stage their fight where brick-and-mortar business is the weakest, the digital world. Many customers don't even realize or recognize that the sacrifice restaurants need to make to even be listed. In addition to limiting profitability to the point of forcing restaurants into the red, purchasing from food delivery services directly impacts the livelihoods of all team members, including waitresses, chefs, line cooks, owners, and more. When restaurants push hard to encourage direct delivery, they're doing it out of survival. Remember, this isn't a new industry that was built from the ground up around digital precepts. Rather, food industry follows clearly established cost models that cannot sustain webheads stealing their lunch. Here's some food for thought for your next venture and future delivery order. Consider that whatever you order, 30% or more is going towards the food delivery service, simply to allow you to discover that restaurant, process a payment, and organize a delivery. Many restaurants have now built up their own digital platforms to process payments and deliver in much the same way. If you truly love the food that you're ordering, do that restaurant a solid favor and order direct, knowing you're helping them stay in business and keeping that money where it should be, in the food, not the technology industry.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.